Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from Cavalry Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Muhammad Kayomi, president of San Jose State University. Would like to extend special thanks to Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting tonight's program. It's my pleasure to introduce best-selling author Dr. Khaled Hosseini. The eldest of five children, Dr. Hosseini was born in Kabul, Afghanistan. When he was 11, his family relocated to Paris, where his father was assigned a diplomatic post in the Afghan embassy. But with their home country in political unrest, instead of returning to Afghanistan, the Hosseini family received political asylum and moved to San Jose, California, when he was 15. Dr. Hosseini graduated from Santa Clara University, received his medical degree from UC San Diego, School of Medicine, and completed his residency in internal medicine at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. While practicing medicine, Dr. Hosseini wrote his critically acclaimed novel, The Kite Runner. The book spent more than 2 years on the bestsellers list and was adopted into a film in 2007, as well as a theatrical play. Moreover, the book was also converted as a curriculum packet that is used for high schools. And most recently, it was released as a graphic novel last month. His second novel, A Thousand Splendid Suns, also became an international bestseller. Both books have been published in over 80 countries and sold an astonishing 37 million copies worldwide. Dr. Hosseini is also a goodwill envoy to the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, and founder and president of Khaled Hosseini's Foundation. The foundation was created to provide humanitarian assistance to the people of Afghanistan through projects that provide housing for refugee families, as well as economic support, educational opportunities, and health care for women and children. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join in welcoming Dr. Khaled Hosseini. Hosseini, it's a pleasure to see you again. And Ralph, looking at Kite Runner, it has been an amazing book, a book that has really shown the beauty of Afghanistan as well as the calamities that the country has suffered and the displacement of people, and especially many coming to the U.S. and other countries and then settling over here. To what extent some of the character that you see in Amir represents some of your own experience in Silicon Valley?
Well, it's kind of, this is probably the most commonly asked question from novelists, is how much of their lives, their personality, their experience actually is reflected on the pages of what they write. And I think it's very, very difficult to write fiction, especially a novel, writing from a emotional, personal vacuum. You have to ultimately draw from your own experiences, from your own insights, from your own travels to create character, to create story. So there's a lot of me in this book in one sense, in that, you know, like this boy, Amir, the protagonist of this novel, I grew up in Kabul in the 70s. I went to the same school. As you know, kite flying in Afghanistan is very popular, so that's something we all did as children. I love the writing stories as a child. I began writing from a very, very young age. And so I recreated that world based on from my own life. The same thing in the United States. The sections, the middle third of the novel is set in the Bay Area. The main character and his father flee Afghanistan because of the Soviet invasion. They come to the United States, here locally in the Bay Area, and they try to make a life for themselves. You know, and I remember very vividly what it was like when I was 15, when I came to this country with my family. We were 9, on welfare, trying to make a life for ourselves, not speaking the language, completely foreign to the culture, and not understanding the environment. And so I had gone through that very much personally. And so I could recreate that experience for Amir and for his father and try to imagine what it would be like for this father-son duo to try and resurrect some semblance of domestic life here in the U.S.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, looking at some of the key characters of the book, such as Amir, Ali, Hassan, Rahim, Soraya, Sorab, and so on. Of course, some of these words have names have special meanings in Persian or Arabic. Were there any particular reason that you use these particular names? Like, for instance, Amir meaning princess or prince, or Soraya meaning constellation of stars, or Rahim meaning somebody who is the forgiven.
Forgiving. Yeah, it's. You know, sometimes the names are names that I felt fit the character. Sometimes they're chosen for a specific reason. Rahim Khan, for instance, his name meaning, forgiving, and kind of kindness and so on. He's sort of the represents for our central character who's very troubled morally and stands on very kind of shaky ground as far as his morals and as far as his personality is and integrity. Rahim Khan is kind of like his beacon, sort of his moral beacon, sort of his moral consciousness. And so for that reason, that name was chosen. The character of Sorab, for instance, who's the little boy that is a relation of the main character, and the main character goes on this journey to Afghanistan to retrieve this boy and has a series of experiences in Kabul while looking for this boy, Sorab. His name comes from the great Persian masterpiece, Shahnameh, the Book of Kings. And there's this kind of father-son motif running through the kite runner, and there is a father-son very famous poem in the Shahnameh, the father Rustam and his son Sorab, who are father and son, and they don't know each other, and end up meeting in battle, and the father slays the son without knowing it's his son, and the painful revelation is made at the last minute. It's a great tragedy, of course. And so the name of Sorab was chosen both for that allegory and also because Amir and Hassan grow up reading the Shahnameh, and that's their favorite story. So also fit the story.
Okay, great. Well, let's continue on talking a little bit about kite flying. And there's one question from the audience on how you put all of that glass over the string or attach that wire.
You could probably answer that question as well as I could. I'm sure you had the same experience as I did. But basically, so when in the West, when you think of kite flying, it's kind of this leisurely activity that you do on a picnic on a Sunday, maybe at the beach, and the kites are very ornate and very beautiful, and you fly them, and there's an aesthetic emphasis on it. In Afghanistan, it's really kind of more of a competitive sport. The kites are actually very Spartan. They're built for maneuvering. They're not really built for, they are decorated to some extent, and they're lovely to look at, but that's not the main. The main purpose is for them to be very easy to maneuver. And the strings are very special because there's a mixture of glue with finely ground glass that is made, and the glue is water based. And when that you take the string, and then this is what we used to do. We used to soak the skin in this mixture, basically run the string through this mixture of very finely ground glass and glue. And then when you dry the string, all those tiny particles of glass are coating the string. So when you use the string, it's very sharp. Once it's dried, then you can fly your kite and try to cut the other guy's line using your glass string. And then, of course, everybody in Kabul prided themselves on having the sharpest string, and everybody had a secret formula on how to get the sharpest strings in town. And it became kind of like this very, point of pride and competitive thing. I'm sure you've flown a few kites with a glass string yourself.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more. Let's elaborate on the kite flying a little bit more. And as you talk in the book, that basically cut your opponent's kite cut, and you kind of represent the whole fragility of life there. Was there a deep deeper meaning about the condition of life in Afghanistan that you wanted to portray also?
Well, I think those are the sorts of things I like to leave up to readers at the risk of sounding very precious and highfalutin. You know, it's like somebody says, you know, you write a book and then you let other people tell you what it's about. So for me, you know, there's certainly a just from a story, the story itself, the idea of the kite flying, I thought it was a very visually powerful motif to have these beautiful kites kind of jostling each other over the sky. Now, over the years, people have written me and these beautiful, long, elaborate letters about what exactly the kites mean, and some of them are actually very creative. And I've been tempted to say, you know, that's why I did it, and then just kind of say it in public and sound really smart. But for me, like for instance, somebody said that Afghanistan itself has been like a kite and its string has been jerked by all these different people. And, you know, it's just people get really creative with it. But, you know, for me, if I have a central image, memory of my childhood in Afghanistan, in some ways it's those kites, those long winters that I spent with my brother, with my cousins at home, with the school closed down for 3-4 months, and long days of flying kites on the street. And the kites kind of brought us together. And it was a way for boys to get together and be boys and talk about things that boys care about. But it also, for me, is kind of like this kind of a central image of a childhood in a country that has transformed so profoundly. That when I grew up in Kabul in the 1970s, and this may sound strange now, but it was actually a really nice place to grow up and be happy. And I was. I had a very happy childhood in Kabul. And so for me, the kites, when I think of them, they represent that era, that time and place, pre-Soviet war, pre-Taliban, pre-Al-Qaeda, pre-Bin Laden, pre-suicide bombing and landmines, at a time when we would go from Kabul to Herat and forget to lock our door. We would come back and nothing had happened. I grew up in Kabul. I never heard a gunshot. I never heard a gun go off. And so for me, the kites are kind of like representative of that more, I guess, peaceful, more innocent time.
Let's talk a little bit about the character of the father, Baba, and as you represent that, want to show somebody larger than life, very machismo, reckless, and courageous, archetypical Pashtun, and at the same time, his major pastime is a sport from the northern part of the country.
Yeah.
Was there anything specific, you know?
No, I mean, you're talking about Buzkashi.
Yeah, Buzkashi.
Buzkashi, yes. Does everybody know what Buzkashi is? So Buzkashi is the national sport in Afghanistan. And it's going to sound somewhat strange, but it's played on horseback, sort of like polo. And there's two, three dozen horsemen, each representing a certain area. And basically, you have the carcass of a goat. That is in the center of a circle in the middle of the stadium, and then what you're supposed to do is to grab that thing and then gallop around the stadium one full circle and come back and deposit it back in that circle. But while you're doing that, you're being attacked from every corner by the other horsemen who are trying to rip it from you, and they can kick you off your horse and whip you, and it's very violent. And very, very tough sport. There was actually a beautiful novel about it written by the French novelist Joseph Cassel, who wrote about it, and it was made into a film that has very little recognition here, but it was a Franco-Italian, I think, production called The Horseman with Omar Sharif and the late Jack Palance. Visually striking, actually kind of a beautiful movie. It is from the north, but my experience has been that whether you're Pashtun from the south or whether you're a Hazara from central Afghanistan, that's, you think of it as the national sport. And there was I could tell the brief story, there was an attempt to recreate it here in the U.S., which is kind of funny. I don't know if you were...
I heard about it.
Yeah, so in November a couple of years ago, the Afghans in the East Bay said, we should recreate this here. And it was a lovely idea, except they ran into all sorts of logistical problems. This is not Kandahar. So, PETA said, well, you can't use a dead goat. And then they said, well, you can't hit each other. And then they said, you can't use whips. And eventually what it turned out to be is that all the horsemen were all Americans. I don't think there was a single Afghan. They were all rodeo cowboys. And they were dragging around sort of this, was it like a burlap bag that was full of sand or something?
So it took all of the excitement out of
it. Well, it was the most polite game of buskashi I've ever seen, So.
Okay. Well, let me go through some of the questions that you received from the audience. There's one question about, stating that you, in both Kite Runner as well as The Thousand Splendid Sun, you've in great detail explained the delicious dishes of Afghanistan. Can you recommend any places around the area about Afghan cuisine?
Is that kosher?
Afghan cuisine, yeah.
There's a lot of good Afghan food. There used to be, there was like one or two. But if you want to go and have Afghan food, thankfully in the Bay Area, you have a lot of choices. There's two places in Sunnyvale, right there on El Camino, that you can go to, right off of Matilda and El Camino. And then if you go on Fremont Boulevard, there's an entire area that is now known, unofficially at least, as Little Kabul, that's full of a bunch of like mom and pops kind of hole in the wall places, as well as bigger restaurants, and they're all terrific. So right off of Fremont Boulevard, but Afghan food should be warned, is very good. And I have the experience of when people try it once, they like tell all their friends, and then they keep going back. So there's very few Afghan restaurants that close down once they start. And like takes off.
Maybe inertia holds on to them and they don't want to close them down. Well, let's talk about some of the expressions that the Persian or Dari expressions that you've very skillfully added in the book. And somehow, being from a Pashtun family, there wasn't any expression in Pashto. Was there any? Was that specific or is?
No. But I can only write about the way I grew up. And I grew up in Kabul around a lot of people, many of whom were from a Pashtun background. But my experience was that in that kind of semi-westernized, affluent, kind of upper-middle-class milieu, even if people were from... They largely spoke Farsi. They were Farsi speakers. And my Pashto is very bad. And so I didn't want to offend any of my Pashto-speaking friends.
Well, I think in the book you very skillfully talk about the whole sense of the generational gap between how young people relate to being moved and uprooted and coming to a different culture versus the older generation, where you talk about America for the young, America is the land to bury one's memories, while for Baba, the father. It was for the older generation. This was a place to mourn, his memories.
Right. That again. My family came to the States in 1980, shortly about a year or less than a year after the invasion by the Soviet Union. So we moved to the States. My father, who was a diplomat at the foreign ministry, and my mother, who was a vice principal of a large high school, both. In Kabul, both were educated professionals that had worked their whole lives. And I remember very vividly what it was like for them to come to the States as middle-aged people with five kids and not be able to speak the language properly and having lost their bearings. For them, I can only appreciate now in hindsight that I am the age they were roughly when they came here. What it must have been like, for instance, for my father to bring five kids and his wife and his mother and my aunt here to the U.S., it must have been very, very daunting. For the kids, like for me and my siblings, it was a little different. Our assimilation was, I think, smoother in a way because we're much more malleable, much more adaptable. We're not as set in our ways. We haven't worked half of our lives to establish a career. So it was smoother. Although I should say that the age of 15 is a very tricky age, regardless of where you are. And you're struggling with the issue of identity and the kind of trying to fit in, and you want to be accepted. And I remember when we came, I didn't speak in English. Maybe I spoke 4 or 5 words, a couple of phrases. And I went straight to high school 2 weeks after we arrived. I went straight to a normal English class. And I felt completely lost in high school. And I remember very well, I had trouble making friends. And the first year that I was there, I hung out with these Cambodian kids who hardly spoke English as well. And they largely spoke Cambodian. At lunchtime, I would sit with 10 of them, and they're all speaking Cambodian and eating their food. And I just kind of sat with them. But I felt like even though we couldn't really communicate that well, I felt we had something in common. We had come to this country for very similar reasons. And so we had that bond that we were here because something had been lost. And we were that generation of kids growing up, and our parents were all making the same sacrifices for us. So that's maybe if all the passages in The Kite Runner, this idea of the immigrants and of the families resettling and the parents sacrificing to make a life for their kids who are expected then to go to school and so on, that probably resembles my life more than anything else.
Okay. Which brings me to another similar related question. That is, how do you maintain your heritage while also being an American, living an American life?
It takes work because the ambient culture is very powerful, and it can overwhelm you. And by that, I mean, I will always have that part of. I don't try to maintain that alive in myself because that is part of who I am, and I never think about sort of the duality of my identity. Unless somebody on stage asks me, which then I think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, I've learned how to live with the two coexisting. But it's really an issue for my children, for instance, because they have never lived in Afghanistan and they have never seen Kabul, and so for them, you actually have to take steps to instill in them a sense of heritage, a sense of ancestry and identity. So the first step towards that is language, because I think without language, a lot of doors get locked or closed to you. So, I've taken my kids to Farsi school, and they go there on every Tuesday, and they've learned how to read and write Farsi. And, we set aside certain times where they can only speak Farsi to us, and I will respond only in Farsi. And so they do very well, and I hope that when they're a little bit older, they'll actually appreciate it as well. other than think of it as just, oh, it's Tuesday afternoon and we have to go. But I think language is a gift, and so is, it enriches you to know that you have this heritage and this tradition, and mm-hmm. you come from a country that has this very beautiful and tradition and so on. I think they'll only appreciate it with time.
Okay. Well, the question is, why did you decide to use San Jose State as part of the Kite Runner, and why not any other college? Although being from San Jose State, I'm very appreciative that you did that. So.
It's the hometown university. I'm from San Jose. San Jose State is the hometown university. I actually went to Santa Clara, certainly more affordable to go to San Jose State for Amir. His dad's working as a mechanic in a garage. So I thought probably he would go to state.
I definitely agree with you on that one.
I've taken a peek at what it costs to go to some of these local universities these days. It's kind of appalling.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about one of the concepts that one of the central concepts of the book, and that was friendship, and talking about friendship between two individuals of different social classes. Over here when we talk about Amir and Hassan.
Yeah.
How do you think that relationship was it tried to showing that those two the relationship could be strong? Was it something that the relationship could be superficial? How did that relationship go through time?
For me, that relationship is the heart of the book, and I think it's the primary reason why this book has surpassed all my expectations. And has become sort of this darling of book clubs and libraries and readers from really all over the world, because it's a relationship that is simple on one level, in that it's two boys who happen to like Westerns and who happen to like to fly kites and to goof around, and who also happen to be brothers, although they don't know it at the time. So it's really just kind of this coming of age story, and it's about a very magical time in every child, especially I think boys, just from my own experience, that age of 11, 12, when you're not really a kid anymore and you're not really like heading towards being an adolescent, but you're kind of in that transition, that middle passage kind of age. And it's a very magical age. A lot of books about that age. So that's something that regardless of where you're from, be it San Jose or Japan, or anywhere, you can kind of identify with that. It's something very universal about the simple joys of boyhood. But also, it's a very complicated relationship because it's touched by history and by the fact that there's a sectarian flavor to it. You know, Amir is a Sunni and Hassan is a Hazara. He's a Shia. There's an ethnic element to it, and Amir is a Pashtun and Hassan is a Hazara. And then there's the issue of class. You know, Amir's father is this very wealthy businessman who was married to a woman who came from a royal family, whereas Hassan comes from a very, very humble background. So it was a relationship that was simple on one level and yet burdened by all of these complications on the other end. And Amir thinks, and Hassan guilelessly thinks, that all this other stuff doesn't matter, that they can just see each other as friends and that it's very pure and simple. And that's kind of how Hassan sees it. But with Amir, this other stuff keeps seeping into how he views their relationship, and it keeps tainting how he views Hassan, and he can't help himself. And it's really not until the end of the novel, when he's a grown man and he's brought Hassan's son back to the U.S., when he is challenged by his father-in-law, who says, you know, who is this Hazara boy? And he says, you just tell people he's my nephew. And he just sees him as his nephew. And at that point, all these other issues have vanished. And he finally sees him as something like an equal. So I think this is the reason why people really love this book. Because this particular relationship works on different levels.
Let's talk about the part of the book, third part, during the Taliban regime and the horror and the haunting images of that era. How much of that, as you were writing the book, was based on what you were seeing in the public media, or were there some other resources that were using in putting in doing that research?
Well, it was inevitable that the images from the media would play certainly a part in me trying to recover. See, I never actually went to Kabul prior to 2001. I went there shortly after. So I was never there technically when the Taliban were running the show, so to speak. But certainly, especially after 9/11, the images became iconic. The shooting of that poor woman in the stadium, the burqa, the bringing down of the Buddha statues, what had happened in 2000. But also, we have, as I said, a very large Afghan community here in the Bay Area, and I would see people at weddings, at birthday parties, funerals, in the park, on the street, and we were always talking, and there were always people who had come back from Kabul, who had visited, and they brought back stories and things that they had seen, and some of it just sounded so bizarre and so surreal that it had to be true. And so, for instance, one man told me that he had seen somebody on a street corner basically trying to sell his artificial limb to somebody else, which is a detail that is so striking and so vivid and so indelible that it creates, it's a very powerful image, it creates an environment, it creates a reality, a mood, for that world. And so I relied also on these kind of eyewitness stories that I had heard throughout the years, but, you know, also from my readings and, of course, the media.
Okay. It's another related question. Can you update us on the status of women in today's Afghanistan society, particularly when it comes to education and medical care for women?
Well, I think the issue of women in Afghanistan is sort of good news, bad news. The good thing is that the situation for many women has improved. We should not neglect the fact that, look, there are things happening in Afghanistan today that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. A quarter of the seats in the lower house of the parliament constitutionally have to be occupied and are by women. A third of all teachers in the country are women. Half of healthcare workers in the country are women. A quarter of all civil servants in Afghanistan are women. There's a provisional governor in Afghanistan who is a woman. Women ran for president and for parliament, and they're on television and on the radio and so on. So these are advances that only the most hardened cynic would dismiss as insignificant. At the same time, the progress that has happened has been largely in urban centers like Kabul. It hasn't gone as far and as deep as you would like, and it hasn't come close to changing the situation for the millions of women who don't live as urbanized professionals or as middle-class people in Kabul. If you go to rural Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is not an urban nation, it's a rural nation. If you go there, the situation for women continues to be very difficult. And in those regions in Afghanistan, for instance, in southern Afghanistan, in eastern Afghanistan, and in other parts as well, in those regions where traditionally women's rights has been hampered by existing customs and traditions and so on, things haven't changed a whole lot since the Taliban left. And frankly, they weren't that different before the Taliban got there. So there are big challenges in terms of bringing women into the fold in Afghanistan, having to do not just with Kabul, but also engaging in meaningful dialogue with tribal elders and leaders, community leaders in those other regions where typically women are barred from public life. And so situation is still difficult for many women. 25,000 plus women still die of childbirth during childbirth in Afghanistan. So there has been progress, but there are still, I think, very significant challenges that have to be faced. And I think that's one of the seminal challenges of the Afghan government.
Okay. Well, in the U.S. and most other places, the schools are closed in the summer, and that's when you have the summer breaks. But why in the novel the schools were closed for 3 to 4 months in the winter?
The answer to that is basically has to do with the elements. People, it's funny because I go to these book signings, and occasionally somebody will come up to me and, like, for instance, the most striking one was a lady came to me and said, I didn't know there were trees in Afghanistan. And, I kind of didn't blame her in a way because, like, when you watch the news, it's always, like, these caves and the desert, and there's mountains. But you never, like, see a tree and a stream, whereas, northern Afghanistan, for instance, is truly, truly, I actually had the good fortune of driving from Kabul all the way up around different cities in northern Afghanistan about 3-4 years back. And I was reminded once again how beautiful that region is, with valleys and with these lush green valleys with rivers and trees and prairies. It's truly, truly remarkably beautiful and striking to look at. And yes, of course, there's the mountains and deserts. Long way of saying that people think also, many people think that Afghanistan is like the Sahara, that it's like this arid, hot, dry desert, and that there's nothing but caves and desert. The reality is that we have the four seasons in many parts of the country. So we have a legitimate winter, for instance. And in Kabul, it snows a lot. It gets very cold. And it's a little bit like Denver, same altitude. We get that kind of snowfall. And so the public transportation is not the best. The roads are not the best, and so when it snowed and the elements got really tough, everybody just stayed home and schools shut down until spring when the snows melted and schools opened up and we went back. So we went to school spring, summer, and fall.
Well, to confirm what you're saying, I have some video footages of newsreel and of Afghanistan in the 1970s, and mm-hmm. It looks more like Yosemite's rather than
exactly.
A desert. Well, there's a question concerning about, your beautiful writing and especially the language that you use. Do you write in different drafts or do you do all that at one time?
So my writing habit is to write a first draft from beginning to end. And I don't outline. I have no idea what I'm going to write that day. I have a general idea of who the characters are, and as I write that first draft, I get to know those characters better and better and better, so that by the time my first draft is done, I feel much more in touch and much more awareness about those characters than I did when I started. They're very, very sketchy for me to begin with. So the first draft, I would sort of, the analogy would be a little bit like when you're moving into a new house. So you shove all the furniture and the carpets and your artwork and all your stuff into the house. So the main essentials are there. And then it's about rearranging everything and removing things that don't belong and adding a few pieces and kind of highlighting it so that you make this place a home. And that's kind of like what the second draft is about for me, is I have the most of the essentials are there, but then when I go back and write a second draft, that's when I kind of have a lot of insights about the story, things that I missed when I wrote the first time. And sometimes they're truly fundamental things. I mean, I wrote an entire draft of The Kite Runner without the very kind of essential detail, I guess, that the two main characters in the novel are related in a way that I didn't realize on the previous draft. And that kind of changed the whole tone of the book. It kind of changed it. It made it a much more interesting and much more moving story. So that's the reason I don't outline. I have no novelists who outline religiously, and then the act of writing the novel is basically to go through that outline, and they know exactly what each chapter is going to be, what each scene even is going to be, and it's just kind of a matter of going through it in a rote manner. Me, it's very open-ended. I really have no idea what I'm going to do, and it works for me because if I outline, the whole idea of spontaneity is removed. I really like not knowing where I'm going. I really like being surprised by my own characters and seeing things pop up that I didn't see coming. And often those tend to be the stuff that I end up keeping, the stuff that sometimes really, really changed the story.
So is that like driving without the GIS?
Well, it's driving like with it is a little bit like, you know, it's kind of like, you're right. It's like driving with a, that's a good, I'm going to steal that. It's kind of like driving with a GPS and you know where you're going to turn in 300 feet. You're going to turn right and then turn left. And then there's a kind of like leisurely driving. You know, you may lose your way a little bit, but along the way, you're going to see some very interesting things. And eventually you'll end up where you need to be.
Okay,
not
great.
Bad, actually.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about the Thousand Splendid Suns. Could you tell us a little bit about what provoked you to write that book, and what's the meaning behind the name of the book?
Well, the meaning, the name of the book, I was desperately looking for a title. I had a number of them. None of them really worked. And then one day I was, you know, I was writing, and I found this poem about the city of Kabul that was written in the 17th century by a poet named Saib Tabrizi. And it was about this Persian poet's love for the city of Kabul that he kind of thought of as a second home. And there was this line in it about, you know, a thousand splendid suns. And just kind of poetically, the poem really worked because it kind of encapsulated one of my character's feelings about the city of Kabul that he was about to leave because of war and conflict. So it really worked and fit into the story. And plus this title, A Thousand Splendid Suns, which is kind of like this idea of hope and brightness and this shining kind of bursting radiance of hope. It, you know, that's kind of where the book ends. And I felt like it would give this otherwise kind of grim book a kind of a real kind of optimistic tone as well. So the title worked for me on various levels. But the reason, what happened is it was kind of a reverse way of what The Kite Runner happened and sort of a reverse way of how I normally write. Normally, I never have a mission. I never have an agenda. I just, there's a story or a character or a line of dialogue or an image that strikes my fancy. And then I will explore it, and some story will emerge out of it. And then that story will become bigger, and there will be themes and stuff that will emerge, hopefully. That's kind of how the Kite Runner started, with just two kites and two boys, and then it became this story about Afghanistan and war and so on. With A Thousand Splendid Sons, it was a little different, because I was fairly intent on writing a book about Afghan women.
Okay.
So there was a bit of an agenda to begin with, because I hardly touched on that in the first novel, and I felt it was like this facet of Afghan history the last 25 years that was fascinating and just rich and tragic and very, very relevant and riveting and important. And so there was that bigger idea. The challenge then was to let a story come to me. And eventually, over time, it did. I actually went to Kabul in 2003, shortly before The Kite Runner was published, and I met a lot of people. At the time, I didn't know what my second book was going to be. But I met many, many people. I met people who worked in NGOs, policemen, hotel doorsmen. I met people from all walks of life. And I heard many stories about what happened in Afghanistan during the Soviet war, the civil war, the Taliban years. And many of it had to do with women. And so when I came home, and I wasn't going there for research, but when I came home, I had all these voices in my head and all these anecdotes and these stories that I could kind of withdraw from to create a credible world for these two women.
So would it be fair to say that maybe that trip and some other experiences were places where you drew a lot of your aspirations about writing the second book?
Yes, okay. Although at the time I didn't know that. At the time I went to Kabul because I hadn't been in 27 years and I was dying to go, and finally I could go, so I did go. But many of the anecdotes and the stories and the details in a novel are things I heard on the street. You know, one example, I met a neurosurgeon at Aliobad Hospital, and we were standing outside on the steps, and he was smoking, and he was like in between operations. And he'd been in Kabul for a number of years, and he told me that during the Civil War, when the rockets were flying and Kabul was basically a war zone, he would operate on people who had lost a limb or been injured without anesthesia because they didn't even have IV fluids or antibiotics. And he said he would deliver babies, do cesarean sections without any kind of anesthetics. And so that was a detail that really struck me, because in my former life I was a physician. And so that made its way. And there's a number of other examples like that in that story.
Well, regarding your days, that when you're a physician, one comment that one of the individuals in the audience who was a volunteer and said it hurts from so many patients, that how so many loving stories and how much you appreciated the great work that you were doing, and they are still affected by that.
Oh,
by
the thank great, you. So these are former patients of mine?
Yes, patients and people
who
work.
I'm very touched. Thank you. Thank you. No, I will run into a former patient usually I remember them. Sometimes I don't. Then I have to admit that, you know, I had 2,500 patients and so.
Sure.
But, I haven't practiced medicine in, it will be 7 years this December. But I still see the people I used to take care of.
Good. Well, in terms of storytelling, who was the storyteller in your family? Was it you? Was it your father? Was it your grandmother?
It was my grandmother. Okay. My grandmother was an amazing storyteller, and people always say, "Who was your inspiration? Which writers have inspired you?" And I never want to say my grandmother inspired me, because it kind of sounds so folksy, and people say he probably made that up, or but actually my grandmother was an incredible storyteller, and there's a long tradition of oral storytelling in Afghanistan, and maybe it's my imagination and kind of a case of the good old days, but as I recall, when I was living in Afghanistan, people told stories, and other people sat and listened for a long time. And now it seems like with the internet and with tweeting and our attention span seems to be getting shorter and shorter, but my grandmother was just a very skilled storyteller, and she told us a story about her trip to Mecca when she was a little girl, and stories about surviving the winter in the village that she lived outside of Herat, and when the wolves would run through the streets of the village and they all had to get locked locked themselves in. So she was a fascinating storyteller, and that's probably one of the reasons why my novels are so story-oriented. I admit fully that you know, there's writers out there who have, you know, logarithmic and exponentially more talented than I am in terms of style and language and vocabulary and so on and so forth. But the strength of my novels are that they're good stories, and you kind of want to hear what happens next and so on. And that's kind of how I was when I was a boy growing up. You know, I was surrounded by people who were very gifted storytellers.
Okay. Well, you know, when your novel also represents when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, they were not liked by people after they invaded Afghanistan. How do you think they feel about the presence of Americans in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the way Afghans feel about the U.S. And its history in Afghanistan is fairly sophisticated. And we kind of tend to simplify the way, you know, they say, oh, they just want us out, or they hate us, or they want us to rebuild a country. Actually, I have found in my discussions with people on the streets in Afghanistan that their understanding is pretty nuanced and sophisticated. On the one hand, they acknowledge the role that the West played in the demise of Afghanistan in arming the country to the teeth in the 80s, really for a self-serving purpose of defeating the Soviet Union. And then when the Soviet Union was defeated, of packing its bags and leaving leaving these heavily armed militias to basically destroy the cities and kill civilians and do as they pleased. And we're paying the price. The Afghan people are still paying the price for that to this day. At the same time, I don't think they view the U.S. presence anything like the Soviet presence. The Soviets were roundly despised. They had a very limited agenda, which was to help support a puppet communist regime. They were seen as godless and atheists. They were seen as had no popular support whatsoever. I have never found that that's the case in my discussions with people, nor have the polls that have been conducted in Afghanistan reflect that that is the case. You know, people do support. People have their grievances, and I think in many cases quite legitimate grievances against some of the things that have happened in Afghanistan under the watch of NATO and the U.S. and some of the way that in which the U.S. and NATO has carried itself and behaved in Afghanistan, often having to do with not enough reconstruction and civilian casualties. At the same time, many Afghans will, almost every Afghan that I have met, and again, the polls support this, will say that life is better than it was 10 years ago. And there's general anxiety in Afghanistan today about what is going to happen in 2014 if indeed the U.S. and NATO decide to pack their bags and leave. What will happen to people in Afghanistan? Is the Afghan state in a position that, are they ready to protect the Afghan people, its borders, its civilians? Or will the country slide back into the chaotic days of the 1990s? And if for that reason alone, if nothing else, there is support for the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan, although not as strong as it was a number of years ago.
Another related question, then, where do you see Afghanistan 10 years from today?
You know, As I say, I hope for the best. You know, Afghanistan has been in turmoil for over three decades. Its people are some of the kindest and hospitable and humble people you'll ever meet. They deserve better than what they've gotten. It's for them, really, that my heart breaks, and it's for them that I really hope for peace to come to Afghanistan. I don't know what the future holds. I like to think that things will work out, that there will be some semblance of peace, that the current state of turmoil that we're seeing in Afghanistan will wind down, that Afghanistan will develop a reasonably functioning and stable civil society, and hopefully the economy will improve and there will be better governance and all the things that we want to see happen in Afghanistan. I don't know if that will happen in 10 years' time. You know, we both know that, you know, state institutions get built over decades, especially in a country that even in its heyday was one of the most impoverished and deprived in the whole world. I hope for peace first and foremost in Afghanistan. I worry about how that peace will be brought about, what the price that we pay for that peace will be, and whether that peace will be lasting. I think that's the main concerns of every Afghan I've spoken to.
Okay. Well, let me bring it back to some aspects of literature and poetry. And could you tell us about who is your favorite Persian poet?
My favorite Persian poet, it's hard to pick, but probably in the end, I would have to say Hafez is my favorite Persian poet. He's not as popular as Rumi is in the West, but Hafez shares many of the same imagery and the same themes, and he's a Sufi as well. But I find his the language that he uses is so rich and so vivid and so beautiful. And it's impossible to try to convey that to a non-Farsi-speaking person because the translations, although very valiant, fall so woefully short of doing justice to the language and to the simplicity and the beauty of his work, that to recommend to somebody to read translations of Hafez is a very, very distant approximation.
I totally agree with you. Hafez is one of my favorite poet as well as my wife. So
yeah,
I appreciate
he's
that
wildly
comment.
Popular in Farsi-speaking
sure.
in Afghanistan and Iran. Much less known in the West.
Let's talk about some of the projects that you have at hand right now. Could you tell us a little bit about them? Are you working on another book?
Yes, I've been at work on another book, another novel. It's been coming along. I had a year in 2009 where I got very little done for all sorts of reasons. And I've started a foundation and I've been quite busy with that. But I've come around to tackling this book pretty seriously, and I've made some good progress in it. I guess I hesitate to talk much about it, not to be because I'm superstitious, I'm not, or I'm trying to be precious, but mainly because I've publicly spoken about a work in progress in the past and promised this particular story. And then 6 months later, that story is sitting on dead space on my desktop and I'm doing something else. Or that story has metamorphosed beyond recognition, whereas what I said before is now utterly irrelevant. So I kind of hesitate for those reasons. But it's a book that is partially set in Afghanistan and partially deals with some of the things that are going on in Afghanistan today and also in the past. And then it also deals with things that I think kind of break a little bit new ground for me as a writer.
Well, maybe you said earlier you're driving without the GPS, so
yeah,
you don't know where it's going to lead you.
All intuition right now.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the graphic novel. The one that just came out and had a chance to review that one. To what extent, in terms of the graphics were reviewed or there was attempts to make sure that it really truly reflects the book?
My approach to this graphic novel was very similar to my approach in the film in that I was very happy to provide feedback and help, but I wanted to let the artist have his own vision without me constantly interfering and constantly trying to change his direction. In order for that to work, I had to have faith in the artist to begin with, so I had to see what he had in mind. And it was my Italian publishers who approached me initially and proposed the idea of doing a graphic novel. And for me, it was a very attractive thing. I will admit, from a vanity standpoint, because I grew up a big fan of comic books. In fact, it's part of the way I learned English. Is I read these Marvel comics, Spider-Man and Iron Man and Daredevil and X-Men, and I read DC stuff like Batman and Superman. I kind of like one of the ways I learned how to speak English in addition to watching sitcom reruns. So I already had a great love for comic books, and later on I got into like Frank Miller's work and Alan Moore, who's brilliant, and then later on into people like Art Spiegelman, and then Majon Satrapi's Persepolis work, which is amazing. So I had a love for the medium already. So I said, yes, let's do it. And I thought also that the story was very visual and that it would make a good graphic novel. There's a lot of emotions in the story, and it could potentially make for a very kind of a moving graphic novel. And my Italian publisher sent me sample work from a series of artists. And then when Fabio Celloni's work was presented, I felt really connected to it. And he sent to me via JPEGs of his idea of what the characters would look like. I loved it. And at that point, we gave him green light and let him kind of take over artistically. And occasionally he would send me an email. But largely he worked independent of me.
Well, risk of sounding very picky, as going through the book, I found a number of things that may not be as consistent with the book, and I'll be interested in your comments. For instance, looking at the kind of clothes that Ali and Hassan had, which were more like Western rather than from Afghanistan, looking at the way that he was holding the tray in one hand rather than two hands that it's done in Afghanistan, the way that kite flying was not from the rooftops rather than from windows, when he was trying to show that car, when the family wants to move from the father's house. And you know, in the book as well as the movie, they bring a car in the story. I think it brings a donkey and trying to, you know, bring a mule for transportation. Also, when they talk about Amir going to San Jose State, the gates looks more like UC Berkeley, the San Jose State. And when you look at when it shows Peshawar, of course, in Pakistan, people drive on the left side or the wrong side of the street rather than the right side of the street.
I should have consulted with you, I suppose.
And continuing on being more picky, if you look at during the Taliban times, the flag of Afghanistan that it shows is the wrong flag. And Peshawar looks more like Casablanca than Pakistan.
Well, look, many of these things, I will admit that, for instance, that driving on the wrong side of the street in Peshawar or all of the rooftops, I might differ with you a little bit. Some of them, frankly, I didn't catch on, and so that's probably on me. Some of it, I think, is a matter of just artistic choice. But the idea is not really, I suppose, to be 100% accurate. That's what you want to be, of course. But it's really, for me, the important thing is that there is an emotional core to the story that has appealed to readers. My great worry was not so much like, you know, Does this look exactly like a street in Peshawar? Although it did to me. I admit I've never been to Peshawar. But whether that thing that made the book such an emotional journey and roller coaster and that made it so endearing and that big heart that the story had, I didn't want that to be lost. That was really the important thing to me. And I think, by and large, quite, I think, successfully, the graphic novel achieves that. It's a pretty powerful and moving read, actually, despite, you know, the driving on the wrong side of the street and so on. It's still a pretty moving read.
I agree with you. Of course, maybe in my case, since I had read the book, seen the play, seen the movie, packet and then look
well,
at this.
I
was looking for details.
I think what he also did was kind of rely a little bit more on the images from the movie. For instance, that central square where the kite flying is on, it resembles quite a bit the square in the film.
Okay. Well, how about, could you tell us something about some of the activities of your foundation in Afghanistan? What are some of the work that they've been doing there?
Well, I started the foundation because I went to Afghanistan in 2007 with the UN refugee agency and saw people who had come back to Afghanistan from Pakistan and Iran after living abroad for many, many years as refugees. And they were living homeless. They were living in holes on the ground. They were living in tents. They were living in makeshift settlements. And so I started the foundation to address the needs of these millions of people who've come back to Afghanistan and are getting very little support from their government, both local and central. Because, you know, this 6 million Afghans returned after the fall of the Taliban to Afghanistan. That's 20% of the population of the most impoverished non-African nation in the world. Imagine if we added 60 million people to the population of the United States and how we would manage that. It would be a big challenge for us. So it's a big challenge for Afghanistan. So many of these people fall through the cracks. So one of the things that we've tried to do with our foundation is to focus on the building of shelters through the UN Refugee Agency for refugee families who've come back to Afghanistan and are living in those elements that I referred to earlier, without proper shelter, without proper protection, which is particularly devastating to children, the elderly, and the sick, and the disabled. So that's been a major part of what we've done, is the provision of shelters. We've partnered with many schools around the country who are reading my novels in the classroom, and we have a curriculum for students to read the book and then go into kind of a service learning component where they raise funds and help build on the fund building of shelters in Afghanistan. So that's been the bulk of what we've done with our foundation. We have funded projects for women and children, employment, healthcare, education in Afghanistan as well. And we have a website, holidaysanyfoundation.org, for anybody who's interested.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we have reached to a point in our program that we have just one last question that we'd like to ask. And that will be in terms of kite flying. You talked a little bit earlier. How much your father encouraged you in flying kites, and how proud was he of your performance as a kite flyer?
As a kite flyer? Well, he didn't have to encourage me to fly kites. I think he was pretty happy we were out on the street and running around. I don't know that I have any memories of my father with regards to the kite flying, but since you brought him up, and whether he was proud of me or not, he's passed on now. It's been a year and a half, but I'm very happy that he lived long enough to see my books published. He lived long enough to go on this movie set with me and kind of walk around beaming with pride and meet everybody. And he was very proud, and he was very, very happy by what happened.
And he definitely was. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program that was brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, would like to thank Dr. Khaled Hosseini, author of The Kite Runner, a graphic novel, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and our audience in Palo Alto, and those who are joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.